Okay. All right, so the work that I'd like to discuss today is really related to general issues of large eddy simulation. And in particular, it's driven by what I might term as real large eddy simulations, applications of large eddy simulations to real flows. And in real flows, there exist boundaries, and it's near the boundary that most of the difficulties in large eddy simulation lie. So this is where we've actually put most of our effort. Yong Cho is my research associate right now, who's working on this problem. Anurag Juneja was my former research associate, who was working on this problem until about a year ago. So most of the work has been done by them. I should also mention that, like everything, there's a history, and there's a number of publications that precede what we're doing now. The stuff that I'm going to discuss today is summarized primarily in these two. This first paper is on the verge of being finished. I was hoping to finish it off today, but it looks like it's going to be tomorrow. So if you're interested, I can give you a copy of that. This one was published in Physics of Fluids at the end of last year. And this work was really based on large eddy simulations that we were doing of the atmospheric boundary layer, where we studied things like Mononobokov similarity, which is law of the wall of the atmospheric boundary layer, and local structure using large eddy simulation. And you know, like everything, you have to examine what the quality of your data is. And there are certain problems with large eddy simulations of wall-bounded flows that people have known about in the geophysical community for a while. And I think it's only starting to become known in the engineering community. This work that we did then is what led to our interest in trying to improve the subgrid parameterization near the wall. And there was some work that preceded what I'm going to discuss today that was done at Los Alamos before fires and before hard disks were lost behind copiers and so on. And it's actually similar to some of the stuff that that Ye Zhou talked about earlier today. And then there's some experimental work that's being done at Penn State as well. I should also say that this is part of a larger effort that involves John Wingard and former research associate like Chenning Tong and so on. And there are some measurements that were made in the atmospheric boundary layer, the atmospheric surface layer, that are also relevant to subgroup modeling. All right, well, this is a schematic of the basic composition of the kind of boundary layer that I'm interested in, although I think that what I say is applicable to all boundary layer flows. But the kinds that we're particularly interested in are the kinds that have both a shear component near the ground or near the wall, as well as a buoyancy-driven component. So there are convective eddies, which are driven by heating at the lower surface, and then, of course, there's a gravity vector pointing downwards. So there's buoyancy motions, which create these plumes. And then these plumes are distorted by shear, where the shear is dominant near the ground. This is the surface layer, the region where shear is large, where the wall effects are large, and where the thermals are growing in size. Another important point is that it's a rough surface. So the issues that we struggle with are boundary layers that have no viscous sublayer. So there are integral scale motions, such as the horizontal integral scale of these vertical velocity components, that scale on the distance from the wall. And therefore, they vanish as one approaches the wall. The integral scale is vanishing as one approaches the wall. This is very important to a large eddy simulation. So we're dealing, I think what I have to say applies to all boundary layers that are high Reynolds numbers, so that you have this kind of inertial range scaling where either a viscous sublayer doesn't exist because of roughness, or because the viscous sublayer can't be resolved just because of the constraints that one has when one does a simulation of this sort at high Reynolds numbers. Can't resolve often the viscous sublayer. The Reynolds numbers are very high. All right, well, this is the issue that's been around in this community. Actually, it was first noticed by Mason and Thompson in 1992, and then Sullivan et al. Designed a model to try to improve the situation. But the problem is this. I'm plotting a non-dimensional distance from the wall. This is called the Mononobokov length scale. It's not important for this problem, but it's negative, which is why there's a negative sign there. And I'm plotting the non-dimensional shear rate, which is scaled on the friction velocity and the distance from the wall in the traditional way. The green line are data that have been pretty well verified from measurements in the field. And these various other lines represent the large eddy simulation. And the main point is that the mean shear overshoots near the ground. And this problem of too large mean shear is something that has been known for a while, although it's only fairly recently that there's been a serious effort made to try to understand what its cause is and what its characteristics are. So for example, these lines represent simulations that we've done. The blue and the red, these two solid lines here, represent the same calculation simply with increased resolution. So you double the resolution. But we wanted to find if the magnitude of the overshoot decreased, and the answer was it didn't. It simply moves closer to the ground, which indicates that it's associated with the grid. If one applies the subgrid model that was designed by Sullivan et al. To improve the situation, then the peak is reduced, and of course, if the resolution increases, it moves to the ground. So we conclude that the subgrid model is a primary element in whatever is causing this overshoot, and secondly, that increasing the grid resolution moves the error closer to the ground, but doesn't remove it. All right, well, the reason that this is happening, those are clues, but the reason it's happening is essentially because of under-resolution. And the message is you can't get away from it. The point is that if you have a situation like this, where certain integral scale motions, like the horizontal scales of the vertical velocity components, are scaling with the distance from the wall, then when you apply a grid, the first grid level is always going to obviously be of order an integral scale. If you refine the mesh, then the first grid level is still of order the integral scale. If you refine it more, it's still of order. It just moves closer to the ground, but the first mesh height is of order the integral scale. And this assumes that the aspect ratio of the grid is of order 1 or greater, which is what you always do when you're doing wall-bounded flows of this sort. So the consequences of that is that integral scale motions of certain velocity components are impossible to resolve fully at the first few grid levels. So here, for example, I'm plotting the horizontal spectrum. This is the spectrum which has been averaged on circles in the horizontal plane for the vertical velocity and then the two span-wise velocities for the case where you have both buoyancy and shear, so that it's anisotropic near the ground. And this is a grid level 16, grid level 8, and grid level 1. The large eddy simulation is a pseudo-spectral simulation, so it applies a hard filter cutoff. And at high enough grid levels from the ground, one actually does capture some k to the minus 5/3 in the spectra, and there's still a strong anisotropic component. And you're resolving really all the velocity components reasonably well. But closer to the ground, grid level 8, you notice that the peak in the vertical velocity is moving to the right, meaning that the integral scale is decreasing. And right at the ground, the peak has actually moved beyond the cutoff. One is not even resolving even the peak in the spectrum for the vertical velocity. So this under-resolution of the vertical velocity is potentially very important, and for this kind of a convectively dominated flow, it's extremely important because these convective motions are very important to the evolution of the boundary layer as a whole. Okay, so one has to deal with this issue of under-resolution in a region, okay, be right with you, in a region where the velocity is strongly non-isotropic and the integral scales are strongly non-isotropic. Yeah, of course.
The peak in
this one?
On the previous slide, peak error was how many
grid levels?
Actually,
that's a good question. I don't know why I never really asked myself what grid level this peak is. Let me think. The blue is a 128 cube simulation. The red is a 256 cube simulation. So you can see that it's been halved because this is going down to the first grid level. So one, I can just rough it out, but I should look and tell you exactly. One, two, it looks like it's maybe third or fourth grid level. This issue of under-resolution of the peak, basically when you're up to grid level of about six or so, then you're capturing most of the kinetic energy, that is 80%, say, of the kinetic energy in all three components or so.
Excuse me, the left-hand side, the scaling, did you jump by the rough resolution?
I'm sorry, please.
The diagram is sort of skated.
This one?
Yeah.
You mean this dash line?
Yeah. Is it illusory?
K to the minus 5/3? I'm sorry?
Is it illusory because on the right-hand side, no, there is no such.
Is it illusion? I didn't quite understand.
Caused by the division.
Oh, this, I just added this dash line.
Yeah.
To show what a K to the minus 5/3 line extension would look like if you drew an extension K to the minus 5/3.
Yeah.
That's the dash line.
Yes.
But is this nothing out here?
K in the spectrum in that diagram. K in the minus 5/3.
Are you asking if these approach a K to the minus 5/3 scaling?
Yes, yeah. The diagram shows.
They do approach a K to the minus 5/3.
But the scaling disappears on the right hand side.
Yes, over here. Yes.
Yeah.
That's right. Because we're not, you know, near the ground, all three velocity spectra change.
Yeah.
These become much flatter, as you can see, so that there's not a well-defined peak near the ground. Obviously, the calculation isn't doing well at this wave number, so there's errors in all three velocity components. The U velocity component, I already showed, has this. The mean is in U, obviously, and we already showed that it's not right.
So the ensembles are different for the same diagrams.
These are three different grid levels. This is grid level 16, grid level 8, and grid level 1.
Different data.
It's the same calculation. But this is right at the ground. This is the first grid level off the ground. This is the 8th grid level off the ground. And this is the 16th grid level off the ground. Okay?
I'm sorry I didn't read your 98 paper. How badly does it affect, and what does it affect the entire boundary?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because you would hope. I mean, the hope is that, I mean, the first thing that we thought of is, well, you hit the thing, in principle, computers get larger and larger. If you hit the thing with enough resolution, you can move the air closer and closer to the ground. That's a brute force way of dealing with the issue. And then, if you could imagine having a very large resolution, then the hope is to get this part of the curve to cover most of the boundary layer, and you're happy. But what we discovered was, because of the convective nature of the flow, these vertical velocity motions actually carry some elements of the air and the structure into the upper boundary layer. And the integral scales, even up into the middle of the boundary layer, the horizontal integral scales were being badly over-predicted. But what's happening is that we have this, if you read the 98 paper, it goes into great detail about this, but the structure near the ground is too coherent, in a way. That there are horizontal rolls, you know, the so-called streaks and so on, they're too strong. And these streaks are the seed points for the structure that's within these thermals. This is a completely different lecture, actually, I'm giving now. And this structure maintains itself as it moves up into the upper atmosphere. And since it's too strong near the ground, because of this too strong shear, it's also too strong above the ground, too coherent, the integral scales are too large. So it's not just a problem near the ground. All right, now I'm just going to do a brief diversion because this is related to something that Ye did. When I was at Los Alamos, we did an analysis that was very similar to part of what Ye was talking about earlier today. And I only want to discuss the part that's relevant to this particular topic. We were interested in the subgrid resolve scale dynamics as well. Basically, I wanted to understand what is the effect of under-resolution on the coupling terms when one is doing a large eddy simulation. So if one writes the equation for the resolved velocity field as a term that involves all the, let me see. Okay, so this is only the part that contains the subgrid contribution. So these are just the couplings between the resolved and subgrid. And you can write this as a sum of terms. Ye called this negative, positive, left arrow, right arrow, left arrow, left arrow, something like this. I use R for resolved and S for subgrid. The point is, this is not really relevant. The point is that we wanted to analyze the characteristics of this subgrid term on the dynamics of the evolution in K space to understand what happens when you're in a situation of under-resolution, and which is the situation near the ground when the peak in one of the spectra, the peaks move to the right past the filter cutoff, and you're in a situation like that. So the question is, what are the consequences of that to the dynamics? And we wanted some scale information, so we were looking in spectral space in order to get scale information. All right, now one can look at it, of course, from an energetics point of view. This is the kinetic energy, change in kinetic energy, and one can look at it from a dynamics point of view, which is the acceleration terms. This would be an acceleration term, and this would be the energy terms, okay? And I don't want to do this complete analysis. I just want to give the main result, which I'll show in terms of the energy transfer, same kind of term that EA was showing earlier. Okay, so these are the calculations we did. We wanted a situation where the filter cutoff was moving into the integral scales, okay, and we wanted the closest thing we could get to on the computer that might have something that you might want to say is like an inertial range. I really hesitate to call DNS, high-resolution DNS, has a real inertial range. I have my own personal doubts about that. But the basic idea is that we do the forcing business, although we don't force randomly. Where is Victor? I was going to make a point of this. We don't force randomly. So anyway, we force the first two wave numbers, wave number 1 and 2, and we force in order to keep the k to the minus 5 third spectrum. We force with 2/6. Okay, so Victor, I'm showing some simulations here, and this isn't the same thing that you were talking about, but I just wanted to point out that not everybody in the world forces wave number 1 randomly. We've been forcing wave number 1 and wave number 2 in a ratio of k to the minus 5 thirds. In a way that doesn't affect the phases, okay, of the Fourier coefficients in those two wave number bands. And the point is that we wanted to look at wave number cutoff in the dissipation range. Here's the dissipation spectrum. Wave number cutoff a little bit farther, sort of between what you might think is an inertial range and the dissipation range, and wave number cutoff 5, which is the closest thing that we think we can get to an inertial range with a 256Q simulation. So this is forced, and then we did isotropic decay. And we're interested in, actually, we looked at this wave number 5 for the force case, wave number 20 for the decay case, and wave number 5 for the decay case. In the decay case, of course, you've got the entire spectrum, including the integral scales. In the force case, you have no integral scales. It starts with something akin to a k to the minus 5 thirds. So there's really no peak in the energy spectrum that you can actually look at in any physical sense. So basically, we looked at 5, 20, and 5. And we wanted to look and see what scales were being affected as the filter cutoff moves into the integral scales between the result and the subgrid. So we're looking at the energy transfer functions that are between resolve motions, that's called TR, and resolve subgrid motions, that's called TS. So the blue are resolve interactions, the TS are resolve subgrid interactions. And this is with wave number, this is with the cutoff in the dissipation range, cutoff in the closest thing we can get to an inertial range, and cutoff at the integral scales. Okay, so if we start off with the cutoff in the dissipation range, okay, this and we're plotting this wave number divided by the cutoff wave number. So k sub c is the cutoff wave number, so that's 1. And then these are larger scales, so lower wave numbers to the left, and we stop at the cutoff wave number. Okay, so at the cutoff, the resolved contribution to the energy transfer and the subgrid contribution to the energy transfer are comparable. Roughly twice the size of structures, twice the size or larger, the subgrid contribution is negligible and it's all resolved contribution. This was with the cutoff in the dissipation range. With the cutoff in the, quote, inertial range, the subgrid contribution and the resolve contribution are of the same order, till roughly scales about 3 times the size of the cutoff, and then the resolve contribution takes over as dominating the energy transfer. However, when the cutoff moves into the integral scale range, then the resolve contribution is negligible compared to the subgrid contribution. The subgrid contribution extends basically all the way through a factor of 3 or more, and it's everything. It dominates all the energetics and it dominates the dynamics. So the message is that in this situation that we're dealing with near the ground, one has to be very much concerned about the accuracy of the subgrid model because it's basically dominating the dynamics in that layer right adjacent to the wall. All right, we did a similar thing. Let me go over the equations the way I write them when I discuss resolved scale dynamics. Okay, so here's an equation for the evolution of the resolved velocity field. I'm going to be using this notation. A subscript capital R involves all of the terms on the right-hand side that contain only resolved velocity. So that would be this inertial term, that would be the pressure contribution that makes this divergenceless, and then that would be the viscous contribution, although that's negligible for most of our situations. And then the red term, the sub S term, represents all the contributions that involve at least one subgrid velocity component. So normally it's written as a stress divergence, where the stress term is the term that's normally modeled in a large A simulation, and then the pressure contribution, which makes this term divergenceless. Okay, and this is often written in two forms, one where the isotropic part has been taken out and moved into the pressure part, and one where it's not. So Snagurinsky uses this form. All other kinds of models use this form. All right. We did a calculation I'll be talking about in a second, for non-isotropic buoyant-generated turbulence, and we did the same kind of thing. We computed the RMS of this term and this term as a function of the filter cutoff moving from the dissipation scales into the integral scales. And as you do that, when the cutoff's in the dissipation scales, the resolved part to this vector dominates. But as the cutoff moves into the integral scales, then the subgrid and the resolved part start to compete, and they're of the same order. All right, so the message is that when the filter cutoff is in the inertial range or in the dissipation range, the primary role of the subgrid model is to get the flux right, is to get the energy transfer from the resolved to the subgrid scales correct. But when the filter cutoff is, as it is near the ground, is in the integral scale range, then it also has to get the dynamics right because the dynamics are competing. The subgrid term is competing with all the other explicit terms in the dynamics. So it's something about the dynamics being wrong that is contributing to this error that we were observing in our LES. Okay, now just to show the subgrid stress is written like this, and I should point out that there are two sort of schools of thought about how one writes these terms, and you notice that I write all of my terms with a second filter on the top because I feel that it's the correct way to do it. It's the way the simulations are done. So you can think of this second filter, if you will, as a de-aliasing filter or as a filter that results from numerical dissipation in your calculation, dissipation that comes from the subgrid model, etc. But whatever you want to call it, that's sort of lumped into this R filter. So if you write it that way, you don't have what's called the Leonard stress term, the subgrid contribution. The subgrid stress tensor has interactions between the resolved scales, a resolved subgrid, subgrid resolved, and subgrid subgrid. This is the term that Ye was pointing out. At least when the filter cutoff is to the right of the integral scale, his claim is that this term is not contributing as much as these two terms, which is probably true. Okay, and then there's the corresponding pressure terms. All right, so the first thing we wanted to do, rather than going into this issue of trying to design a better subgrid model, this is a philosophical statement, but I've always felt that one designs models to improve things that are not as good as one would like them to be. So the question that I wanted to ask is, okay, we want to fix this problem near the ground. I think it's a ubiquitous problem. I think one would find it in all high Reynolds number wall-bounded flows where you're not resolving a viscous sublayer. The first question we wanted to find out was what is going wrong with the calculation that needs to be fixed. We don't know how to fix the problem, or we don't really know whether we fixed the problem if we don't know what's wrong first. Okay, so that's the question. There's four observations that are all important. First is that this is a region near the ground, which means that it's a strongly inhomogeneous region. There's a strong influence of the boundary. The second is that it's a strongly non-isotropic region, both in scale and in terms of component kinetic energy. The third is that the integral scales are being bad, or at least some integral scales are being badly under-resolved. And the fourth is that there are also boundary conditions one has to apply on the vertical component of the subgrid stress and also the pressure. These are the two issues with stars that we've really focused on. We are now moving into trying to understand what specific issues of inhomogeneity may influence it, and we've discovered that the boundary condition and the inhomogeneity issues are coupled and need to be treated as well. So I don't think what I'm going to discuss is the complete answer to the problems, but I think it's the first important answer to the problem. All right, in order to analyze this question, we wanted to remove the influence of a boundary, we wanted to have strong anisotropy, and we wanted to have more than one calculation so that we could try to relate whatever errors are taking place in our simulations, we wanted to be able to relate it to particular structural features in the turbulence itself. Since the atmospheric boundary layer is a convectively driven and shear driven flow, it made sense to look at homogeneous turbulence, which has no boundary associated with it, strongly non-isotropic, driven by buoyancy forces and driven by shear. So we have two calculations that we analyzed. One is a buoyancy-driven homogeneous turbulent flow, and the other is a shear-driven homogeneous turbulent flow. This was first done by Batchelor and Chasnov and another author who I can't think of right now. But this was done back in, I guess, the 80s by Chasnov, I think, did most of the calculation on this one. And this has been done, obviously, since the time of Regalo. But the point is that we have two strongly non-isotropic turbulent flows that have very different structure. In this flow, the vertical velocity is the dominant kinetic energy component. The horizontal velocities have less kinetic energy. So here I'm showing the one-dimensional spectra of the vertical velocity and the horizontal velocity. The vertical velocity has most. And the integral scale of the vertical velocity in the vertical direction is larger than the horizontal integral scales and so on. And you can see that there's a disparity in the location of these peaks as well. So we have two kinds of anisotropy. In shear, it's the horizontal component that has most of the kinetic energy, and it's also the vertical integral scale, the horizontal integral scale that is largest of the vertical velocity. So U is the horizontal and W and V are the spanwise components. It has most of the energy. You can see the kinetic energy is different as well as the integral scale.
So what are the boundary conditions?
Oh, it's the usual homogeneous simulations. So it's periodic boundary conditions, as all homogeneous simulations use. Standard pseudo-spectral. Right, so it's periodic in all three directions. Standard pseudo-spectral.
And they're not closing.
There's no boundary.
No boundary.
No boundary. All right, it's homogeneous, anisotropic, turbulence. No boundary, periodic in all three directions.
So only the temperature gradient is uniform temperature.
No, actually, the way this calculation is done, no, there's no temperature gradient either. The way this calculation is done is there's a Boussinesq term in the Navier-Stokes equation. You start with zero velocity everywhere, but with random, you carry an equation for temperature, a passive scalar equation for temperature, and you start with random initial conditions on that. And because you have gravity, you have a Boussinesq term in your approximation, in your equation, it develops into a turbulence that is generated by buoyancy force.
Temperature distribution is also random, not
well, it's initially random, and then it evolves with structure along with the velocity field. Yeah.
So it's
not
stationary?
No. Neither one of these calculations are stationary. No. No forcing. Random or otherwise. All right. We, again, our point was to try to understand what was going wrong. So although the errors that were discovered in the previous simulations were all done with Smagorinsky models, we wanted to use both an eddy viscosity kind of a model as well as a non-eddy viscosity model. So we chose the similarity model as the obvious non-eddy viscosity model, and the eddy viscosity with the Smagorinsky form, and then three variants of the dynamic form. Again, I don't really want to go into the comparisons of the model because that wasn't really the point. The point is what did we learn about what's going wrong and therefore what needs to be fixed? And there's basically three messages that we came away with. The first, and the, perhaps the most important one, is that we discovered that there's a very important coupling, which is spurious, which is wrong, between the subgrid acceleration term and the resolved velocity that's actually being predicted by the simulation itself. And the way we discovered this was to compute, we were very much interested in the structure of this vector, of the stress divergence vector. We wanted to find out, we realized that since there's an overshoot and shear, that there's probably something that's wrong with the structure that is systematic, and we wanted to try to uncover what that was. So we looked at the statistical structure of the stress divergence tensor, and for example, we looked at the PDF of the direction of the stress divergence tensor relative to the vertical axis. This is for the case of, well, shear and buoyancy. So we looked at, vertical and horizontal. So for buoyancy, it's the vertical axis we're concerned with. For shear, it's the horizontal, because those are the directions of the largest component kinetic energy. And what we found was that when you compared the DNS with the model predictions, that there was a spurious, overly strong alignment of the stress divergence vector always in the direction of the kinetic energy that had most, the direction of the strongest component kinetic energy. So in the case of the shear, these peaks are aligned primarily with the x direction. In the case of buoyancy, they're aligned primarily with the z direction. So in other words, this vector has too strong of a tendency to point in the direction in which the component kinetic energy is largest. Okay? Now we think that that's the explanation, essentially, the explanation for the overprediction of mean shear near the ground, because if the component kinetic energy, well, we know the component kinetic energy is largest in the streamlined direction. So if this vector is overly aligned in that direction, it's going to set up a coupling with the left-hand side of the Navier-Stokes equation that's going to eventually create a velocity that's too strongly aligned in the x direction. Sort of jumping ahead of myself a little bit. Let me back off and explain that again. Okay, so here I'm showing the same result in a different way. I'm showing the anisotropy ratio of this vector, the RMS of the component in the direction that has most of the kinetic energy to one of the perpendicular components. This is for buoyancy and this is for shear. This is the DNS calculation. And Snagurinsky sits way up here in all cases, and this is plotted as a function of the filter cutoff moving into the integral scales. So this would be moving towards the surface. And the point is that Snagurinsky, all of these closures up here, and similarity does as well, it overpredicts this anisotropy ratio. And that's true in both the shear and the buoyancy case. So in other words, it's too strong in the direction in which the component kinetic energy is largest. The alignment is too strong. The second important message that we came away with is that since we realized that the subgrid model near the wall, near the ground, has to have a much more precise prediction for the dynamics, these two terms right here, this should be gradient of pressure, not pressure, mistake. But these two terms have to be predicted at least statistically with some level of accuracy, whereas when the filter cutoff is in the inertial range, then it's primarily the subgrid resolved subgrid flux that has to be predicted. Then the question is, well, if the model gets the flux on average correctly, does it have the possibility to get the intensity of, say, these two terms correctly? Okay, is it possible to get both right at the same time? So what we did is we adjusted the model constants to force the flux to be correct. And then we calculated the RMS of this stress divergence term. We did the same thing for the pressure gradient term. And what we found was that if you adjust the flux, the model to give the right flux, then the stress divergence should be at this line. And in fact, it's badly underpredicted by the eddy viscosity closures. I really don't want to go into the details. And it's also, and it's overpredicted by the similarity model. The point is it can't capture both at the same time. That the models, yes.
But it seems that near the wall, this is what we saw, the bursts are very important. The very strong strong bursts occupying very small parts of the flow. Is there any chance to capture it using the second order moment approaches?
Well, there were two questions. I don't really know the answer to the second question, but I think the issue of bursts being important are when there is a viscous sublayer.
Yes.
Right. And
yeah,
right. And these are the issue I'm discussing is when there is no viscous sublayer.
Oh, okay.
It's either a rough wall or the first grid level is well outside the viscous sublayer, just because the Reynolds numbers are so high you can't resolve the viscous sublayer. So we're really outside of a region where if there is bursting, it's way down in the first grid level. We're not resolving the bursts. That's the issue I'm discussing right here. So I can't really comment on it.
Basically, you do not it's a kind of wall function, right? You don't model the wall at all.
We don't. Well, our application, there is no viscous sublayer. It's for a rough wall boundary layer. But we're also discussing situations that you're describing, where you simply cannot resolve it, or you don't want to resolve the viscous sublayer, just because it's too expensive.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, but the message of this slide, you don't have to focus on the details. The message is that the closures, like Smagorinsky and the similarity model, don't have enough degrees of freedom to capture both the flux correctly, as well as some characteristics like the magnitude, the average magnitude of the vector itself, of the acceleration vector itself. I think it's very important to appreciate the distinction between the energetics and the dynamics. And this actually goes back to when you gave your talk, Victor, and I was commenting that term is not really dissipation. You know, that it's really a force term, and I still been meaning to come and discuss that with you. But it really comes from thinking about this distinction here that made me make that comment. Okay, and then the third message, which I really don't want to go into, really has to do with inhomogeneity, and it has to do with whether the subgrid model can capture the partitioning between the pressure term and the stress divergence term correctly. And the reason we think this is important is because the pressure term is very important near the wall. The inhomogeneity effects are such that pressure transport is very important near the wall. It's negligible elsewhere. But near a surface, pressure transport is very important, and this gives the subgrid contribution to the pressure transport. Since this is large, this pressure term will be large as well. And the answer is that the Smagorinsky model, at least, and the similarity model actually turned out not to do so badly, but the Smagorinsky model actually very badly underpredicts the magnitude of this term. It's almost near zero. And this is consistent with all the simulations we've done since, that the Smagorinsky contribution to the pressure force term is negligible. It just doesn't seem to want to give it any importance at all. Okay, so these are sort of the conclusions from that analysis that we did. First, and what I think is most important, is that there's the strong spurious coupling between the structure, the anisotropic structure, the resolved velocity that's being predicted, and the subgrid acceleration that's being modeled. And this sets up a kind of a feedback loop that keeps enhancing the velocity component that has most of the kinetic energy. So as a result, near the ground, that velocity component is too large, and you add that to the no-slip condition, and you get too large shear near the ground. The second is that the models don't have enough degrees of freedom to capture the intensity level of both the acceleration and the energy, and that the partitioning between the stress divergence and the pressure force is not correct. All right, so this is my schematic of this first point, this coupling. This is what I think is going on near the ground. All right, so near the ground, the horizontal velocity is the dominant kinetic energy because of shear, has most of the kinetic energy. The buoyancy effects are relatively small near the ground. So what happens is that the stress divergence, the sum of these two terms, this vector is pointing too strongly in the streamwise direction. Since this is pointing too strongly in the streamwise direction, the time derivative of the resolved velocity is also pointing too strongly in the streamwise direction. And that causes, since the subgrid model is based on the resolved velocity, that makes the component kinetic energy a little bit too large, which causes the stress divergence again to point too strongly in that direction. And it just sort of sets up a kind of a feedback loop that stops at some equilibrium state that's not exactly clear. But the point is that whatever that equilibrium state is, it's going to have the wrong structure to it. All right, so Now, after having decided that these were essential issues that had to be dealt with a subgrid model to fix the problem, then we set around trying to figure out how to design a subgrid model that could deal with these issues that we uncovered. We actually are, it turns out, we're moving in a direction that's very similar to the direction that Andre Domorodsky has been moving in for the past 2 years. And in discussing with him, I see that we're also kind of converging at more or less the same fixed point. But here's the way it evolved in our group, the way my thinking evolved. All right, we want to do something, we want to minimize complexity. That's one issue, because I am thinking in terms of closures that can actually be applied in real situations eventually, in real LES applied situations. So I think it's important, well, it is necessary to appreciate for the approach that we've taken what we mean by filter, by a large eddy simulation filter. And it's important to appreciate that there's really at least two grids in a large eddy simulation. There's the actual grid of your simulation, which are the black lines. And then there's also a second grid, which is the filtered grid, which would be at a larger scale, these green lines right here. So the black lines will, say, have a grid spacing delta. So in sort of a wave number description, the wave number for that grid, as it were, cutoff would be K delta, say. And the LES filtered grid, the green, would have a spacing, say, delta sub C, or a cutoff in Fourier space, qualitatively, say, would be K sub C in Fourier space. So if you wanted to look at it from a spectral point of view, it would qualitatively, the situation would be something like this. Say, let's say that this is a high Reynolds number spectrum, just a generic high Reynolds number spectrum, and the idea is to do the best that one can do to calculate the velocity on the green grid, because that's your LES grid. So K sub C, which is the inverse of delta sub C, would be your filter cutoff, and I've shown it as a hard filter cutoff, but it doesn't have to be. In finite difference, this would definitely not be. But you could do, in a pseudo-spectral, you can make that a hard filter cutoff, and then what you're trying to calculate is the part that's in yellow there. So that's your resolve velocity right there. But the grid itself, you can sort of think of it as a kind of a second filter, a grid filter. This actually represents the grid. It's a sync function, so it's actually bouncing, but this first zero then would represent the limit of the scales that could actually be represented on the grid. So everything in the dotted portion here cannot be represented in an LES. There's just no hope. There's no grid for it. Okay? The grid starts here, and it's this part of the spectrum right here. When you're doing a large eddy simulation, either implicitly or explicitly, there's a second filter, so the yellow would represent what you're actually evolving in time on the green grid, which is sitting on top of the black grid, which comes to here. So in other words, there's roughly three ranges of scales, and in a large eddy simulation, there's resolve scales. Then there's what I will start calling sub-filter scales. I didn't change my wording. This is an old slide. These would be sub-filter scales that live on the grid, and then there's sub-filter scales that don't live on the grid. So these are sub-grid scales, the dotted line. This sort of orange dash line would be sub-filter scales that do live on the grid. Okay? So the subgrid scales, as a word that traditionally is called, would be, say, US1 this region plus US2 this region. US1, in principle, we could do something with. US2, there's nothing we can do. We simply cannot represent it. We have no grid to represent it. Okay, are there any questions about this? Because if you don't understand this basic point, then everything else is not going to be understandable. That there are these three different regions, two of which live on the grid and one of which don't. Okay, if you're following that, then I can discuss sort of our approach, and I can also explain how it differs from Andre's approach. Our approach is to, well, I mean, our original thinking was to do something along the same lines. What Andre does is he says, I'm going to locally increase the grid. I'm going to make a second refined grid on top of the actual grid, and I'm going to have another grid that moves over here. Okay? We thought, well, if you have to do that, you have to do it. But perhaps we can get away without extending locally the grid, because that's going to be much more extensive, and it's also going to be much more complex. Maybe we can get away with designing a model that takes advantage of this part of the spectrum that is normally just just sort of used for de-aliasing purposes. So we moved in that direction, and so far it seems to be working. So we don't, so far we don't see a need to go beyond this point. So the idea then is to try to do something to estimate the what I call the S1 scales, the velocity in this S1 region that lives on the grid that is subfilter scale. The notion then is that if you could do that, then one would take the subgrid stress tensor and use US1 as a surrogate for US, US being the subfilter scales. Use US1 as a surrogate for US informing the subgrid stress tensor and the stress divergence and then the corresponding pressure term, which I see I've left out of this equation. I'm going to have to redo these slides. But that's the basic, it's very simple. The idea is very simple. See how far we can get by estimating this US S1. All right, now the question is, well, okay, so all right, so here's just a summary then. So here's the idea. See if it's possible to estimate US1, say write some dynamical equation for US1, and then form a modeled subgrid stress tensor by replacing US with US1, and then perhaps with a model constant sitting in front. And then this would hopefully have, if you can do a good job of it, would have a structure that is closer to the exact one. But one has to realize that you can never get an exact representation. This is the exact subgrid stress tensor, then the model subgrid stress tensor, which is going to have errors. Even if you could get this model subgrid stress tensor exact, even if you could predict US1 correctly, you still haven't predicted the stress correctly because there's another contribution from all of those S2 scales that haven't been included. So we have to accept that we're going to have error no matter what.
But yeah. I kind of just think of this as a two-tier subgrid model. So there is.
It is a two-tier subgrid model. Yeah. Go ahead though.
So then there is a subgrid model that you're trying to write down by shuffling, introducing this US1, right? Mm. And there's even CUDA model that. The factor employed for calculating S1, right? Which is presumably just numerical dissipation.
You mean R when you said the CUDA model for R?
Well, no, on the contrary, that's a refined model you're trying to elect for UR, mm-hmm. but which relies on US1, mm-hmm. and US1 is.
Resolve
everything, that's
okay. I was going to come back to this point at the end, but let me sort of go through my reasoning again here. The way things are being done right now is you try to evolve UR and you use your simulation of the yellow region in order to estimate this subgrid stress tensor. So if you're using, say, an eddy viscosity closure, you would take the resolved strain rate field, which are contributions primarily at the filter cutoff, near the filter cutoff, and you would algebraically represent the subgrid stress as proportional to that resolved strain rate field times a nonlinear eddy viscosity. Okay? So you make no use of any information except for the yellow in classical. In similarity models, they're all the same. They use no information except for the yellow. Those are algebraic models. So the idea is, well, we want to get away. We don't want to use the yellow region because we're in this situation where we're not resolving integral scales. So we really don't want to use this. We want to try to go this way if we can. Right? So the notion is, well, let's see if we can do anything with this region here. And if that doesn't work, we'll have to do something more like what Domorosky does and try to push a little bit farther to the right using some other approximate technique. Now, I'd like to come back to your other point, too, because this was something that was confusing me for a long time. And after discussing with Anjay, I've come to appreciate why this thing seems to work. But I'd like to leave that for the end if I can. All right, so. You can ask the following question. You can say, well, look, I have DNS. Let me just take from a DNS, let me just calculate US1, and let me stick it into here, and then let me calculate the stress divergence, since it's the divergence of the stress that I'm really interested in, and it's the structure, it's the anisotropic structure of this that I think is going wrong, and let me see whether there's enough of the right structure in this region that even if I could, in principle, calculate it exactly, it would do a better job. I mean, that's obviously the first thing you'd want to check. So the first thing we did was We calculated the S1 term as one would do in a standard pseudospectral LES calculation, and we calculated US, and we calculated the stress divergence, and we took the anisotropic ratio, the anisotropy ratio, the third component over the one component, RMS, of the third component over the one component for the buoyancy-driven calculation. And we just wanted to see if statistically we could get this ratio more correct, okay, or whether it would still give us roughly the right anisotropy ratio as a function of the filter cutoff moving into the integral scale. So the integral scales actually begin somewhere around, that is, the peak in the energy spectrum is somewhere around 6. So we do most of our calculations at 4, so we're a little bit to the left of the peak in the energy spectrum. The black is the DNS calculation of this ratio using the complete sub-filter velocity, and this yellow line is the one using US1. And to be honest, I've forgotten what the purple line is, but I know that the yellow line is the one using US1. And this made us very happy because it showed that even as the filter cutoff moves into the integral scales, it's tracking quite well the structure of this ratio. So if it's possible to predict, this is of course assuming an exact prediction for US1, if it's possible to do a reasonable prediction of US1, then it should improve the situation.
How would this compare with the no boundaries? So how would this compare to our dear hyperobscurus? You just use when there were no boundaries, you just put Laplacian in higher power, and you have very good results.
Well, hyperviscosity
is going to
wipe this out. So yeah. Hyperviscosity will create this, what I'm calling this Delius region, but you still have to calculate you have to still calculate these terms. Yeah. I mean, you still have terms in your equations that aren't being calculated. If you're wiping this out, you still got to calculate the resolved subgrid interactions. So you still have a model term that you have to deal with. So I don't know how you're dealing with it. I mean, you haven't gotten rid of this term. I'm not quite sure what it is. This is actually calculations you've done?
Quite a few. Again, Baru and others are quite a few papers.
But they're DNS, they're DNS-like calculations,
yes.
Right? You're resolving all the way down to the dissipation.
Up to hyperviscosity.
Yeah. Okay. Well, in that case, basically what you're doing is you're shrinking the dissipation range, but you still have an inertial range in your calculation.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's not a problem. You're getting the flux right and all of the rest of it.
Yeah.
And basically what you're doing is you're just shortening the dissipation range.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of like a subgrid model.
Yeah, sure, definitely.
Yeah, when you're in a situation like that, I mean, you can do almost any subgrid model works well down there. Okay, alright, so how do we calculate US1? Well, we write down the exact equation for US1, and then we look at what we can calculate explicitly, and then look at what has to be modeled. So this is the exact, it's a bandpass filtered velocity, and it has three terms that can be calculated explicitly. Then it has a pressure term, which of course you can always calculate from a Poisson integral. It has a viscous term, which isn't a problem. And then there's a term that can't be calculated. So the three terms that can be calculated explicitly, of course, are the terms that involve interactions between the S1 scales and the resolved scales. So there's three groups of these terms. Okay? This would be two resolved and one S1. This would be two S1 and one resolved. And this would be all local in S1. So this is this would be like the, I guess, Yeh's eddy viscosity kind of thing. And then there's this term here, which involves interactions between the resolved and S2, between S1 and S2. None of these terms, of course, can be actually explicitly calculated. So the point is then that this term has to be modeled. So what you're doing is you're replacing a model, an algebraic model, for the subgrid stress in the resolved equation with an algebraic model for this term. And the hope is that getting these three terms at least approximately correct, because they can be calculated explicitly, will give us a sufficient improvement to the structure of the S1 velocity field that it will have the necessary improvements that we want when we're actually doing the LES simulation for UR, the resolved velocity field itself. All right, so again, the idea is if we get these three terms roughly correct, then hopefully we're going to get the primary structure, the one that we're after, we're going to get the structure of this term right. And even though we don't know how to calculate this term, we're hoping that it's primarily a dissipation kind of a term, it's a flux kind of a term, so that we can use just Smagorinsky or something very simple on this, and that this will carry most of the dynamical information that we're interested in. And that apparently turns out to be the case because it seems to be working. All right, so there's one other point, though, that has to be brought up. We cannot calculate these three terms exactly. We can calculate them explicitly, but we can't calculate them exactly. And this is where I think how this model is working sort of comes in. I think it's really important to appreciate the issue of aliasing errors when you're doing a cutoff that's way up in the integral scale range, even in the inertia range. All right, if you're cutting off down in the viscous range, Victor was saying with hyperviscosity, if you're cutting off where the energy is very low, there's not much aliasing errors. But when you're cutting off up here, there's a lot of aliasing errors. That's why you have to do another filter. There's no way you can calculate these three terms without introducing aliasing errors into your calculation. And what I've come to realize after talking with Anjay is that the reason I think this model is working is because we're doing a better job of, we're still de-aliasing the resolved scales. And what we're doing is we're confining our aliasing errors to this region here, but in doing so, we're still apparently predicting a velocity field that's good enough that we're getting an improvement on our subgrid stress tensor. But these guys here, these three terms are going to be filled with aliasing errors, particularly this one right here, will be filled with aliasing errors, and there's just nothing we can do about it unless we were to do something like what Anjay does and then introduce yet another grid out here. All right, this term here, which I call the vector, this is the divergence of that stress we simply modeled as Smagorinsky, which does affect the phases, so that's another error that we're introducing. But again, since it's working, we went ahead and did it. And then we replaced, so we evolved this equation and we replaced US with US1, and that's it. That's the model. All right. So here's what we tested it on. We tested it on our buoyancy-driven calculations. First, Anurag did calculations with 64 cubed just to see how it was working. And now Young has redone his calculations much more carefully with 128 cubed. And it works better the second time than the first time. So we're quite happy. We still have to, now we're testing this on our LES of the atmospheric boundary layer. So it's still a homogeneous anisotropic calculation. The spectrum, actually this is the 64 cube spectrum. Let me show you I'm going to show you the 128 cube results. So this is the 3 one-dimensional spectrum. This is the vertical velocity spectrum and then the 2 horizontal velocity spectrum. The peaks are displaced significantly and obviously the vertical velocity has a lot more energy in it. We're applying our filter cutoff right here, so we're doing a really bad job of resolving this spectrum, and we're also not doing a particularly great job of resolving this spectrum either. So the UR scales are these cross-hatched, US1 are these backward cross-hatched, and then the dotted ones are US2, which are not on our grid. When we do the LES, of course, we have to apply a grid, and this is the cutoff for our grid. And we compare it with the DNS. The way we do the calculation is we have buoyancy on, it generates the turbulence, and then because the buoyancy term is such a dominant term in the equations, we wanted to take it away so that it doesn't dominate the dynamics. So we turn it off, and we have a decaying anisotropic turbulence that was generated from buoyancy forces. The subgrid term evolves like this, the resolved acceleration term evolves like this, so the subgrid acceleration is larger than the resolved acceleration for about 1.5 eddy turnover times. All right, now this was our first really exciting result. Since we are turning buoyancy off, the turbulence goes through a non-equilibrium transient stage. So this is the flux, the resolved subgrid flux. The black line is calculated from the DNS, and the flux actually increases. It's negative, obviously. It increases, and then it sort of asymptotes, so it goes back into equilibrium. And this bump here Snyder-Rinsky model can't capture that bump. It's an equilibrium model. So Snyder-Rinsky model just does this. Our model is this line right here, and it seems to capture the trends very well. We were quite pleased about that, and it goes into the right answer, as does Snyder-Rinsky. Snyder-Rinsky does very well for energy flux. Similarity model, on the other hand, completely bombs out. When the filter cutoff is so far into the integral scale range, the similarity model gives the wrong sign. You know, I mean, you're cutting off, you know, to the left of the peak in the energy spectra, or two of the energy spectra, and it actually predicts that energy is going the wrong way. So the similarity model is just simply can't handle the situation at all. When the filter cutoff is out, you know, at 20, then it does just fine, as it should do. It's designed for the inertial range, and it does very well there. Okay, so the first thing we wanted to check.
The similarity model is filtered twice too?
The similarity model has a second filter to it, right. So you've got this other filter right in the region where you don't want it to be. Okay, so this is the first thing we wanted to look at to see whether this approach was getting the structure of that subgrid acceleration vector right. So this is the RMS of the vertical to the horizontal component of the subgrid acceleration vector, okay, as a function of time with the filter cutoff where I showed it to you. The black line is what we should be getting. We already knew that Snyder-Rinsky overpredicted. This was our piece of the fluids paper, and this calculation also shows that Snyder-Rinsky badly overpredicts. It's laying too actually it's too high in this case. It's pointing too high, so it's overpredicting that ratio. But this model seems to be hanging in there pretty well. Interestingly, we since the resolved part of the right-hand side, you know, the resolved vector, is evolving with time. At time zero, the anisotropy is the correct answer, but obviously the subgrid vector, the subgrid model, is going to cause the resolved term to go wrong as well. So I'm plotting the anisotropy ratio of the resolved vector as well. And what's interesting is that because the Snyder-Rinsky goes wrong in the subgrid contribution, it also causes the resolved part, the explicitly calculated part, to go wrong as well. So it's a double whammy. Whereas this approach that we're taking, again, seems to be doing okay. All right, but what we ultimately wanted to get right was the anisotropy of the velocity field itself that's being predicted. Okay, so here I'm showing the anisotropy ratio. This is the RMS of the vertical velocity to the horizontal velocity, plotted as a function of time for this calculation. Snyder-Rinsky, as we already knew from our previous work, overpredicts this ratio, and this is the bottom line for us. This model seems to be hanging in there pretty well. When you move the filter cutoff to the right, so you're starting to resolve better, then Snyder-Rinsky starts doing better, and our model, of course, does better as well. And if you keep moving it over, Snyder-Rinsky does better and better. But interestingly, Snyder-Rinsky will actually cross this, and it'll start going wrong again down here. Presumably, it'll pick up and get better again. But the point that I'm making is that this model that we've designed is specifically designed for the situation where the integral scales are under-resolved. As the resolution gets better, Snyder-Rinsky starts doing better, and similarity and all the rest will start doing better as well. All right, so that's just to sort of summarize then. The message is that we discovered in our previous work that the essence or an essence of the problem near the ground when you're not resolving a viscous sublayer is that there's this spurious feedback loop that's being generated between the structure of the resolved velocity and the acceleration vector, and that this has to be broken down in a dynamically meaningful way in order to improve the situation. Which means that whatever model that one introduces has to at least statistically get the structure of this vector right. Now, real situation is more complicated than this model calculations that I did. I just want to make this point that we're not out of the woods by any stretch of the imagination. In the real situation, we have buoyancy forces, and they generate these thermals, which create large sweeping motions near the ground. So that the energy spectra actually look like this in the situations we deal with. The horizontal energy spectrum near the ground has most of the kinetic energy, and it's the largest scale. The vertical velocity has the least amount of energy, and it's the smallest scale. It scales on the distance, the integral scale scales on the distance from the ground. So we have a situation where we have to get the dynamics in this region right, but we also have a very large disparity between the component kinetic energy of the horizontal motions and the vertical motions, and there are certain sweeping effects that we think we have to get right as well. This came out of the experimental work, and it's yet to be tested whether or not these sweeping effects are sufficiently represented by our model to get it right. Okay, so to summarize then, the model is, we based our model on a prediction of this sub-filter scale velocity. So far, we have decided that it's not necessary to introduce a second grid the way Anjay does in his work, and so long as we can get away without introducing a second grid, we won't, although we do have some thoughts about when it will be necessary to extend at least approximately farther down into the sub-grid region for other applications. Okay, so that's it.
Neglected component of US2 is always negligible.
No, well, the answer is I don't know, but I don't think it. I think it depends on the application. The point is that US2, unless you do something much fancier than a standard large eddy simulation, there's nothing you can do about US2. It simply doesn't exist on your grid. And unless you do something like introduce locally another grid, which is kind of defeats the purpose in a sort of, in a sense, of large eddy simulation, there's really nothing you can do about US2.
Generally public, but what the model says about the wall. So let's say we are one grid off the wall, mm-hmm. and you have this resolved velocity component. Okay? And that's of all information we have, right? Mm-hmm. Now, what does your subgrid model say about the effective dynamics of this resolved component, the one grid spacing off the wall.
So what do you mean by what does it say about it?
Well, basically there is an equation of motion with all the assumptions.
Yeah.
There's an equation of motion for, u, one spacing off the wall.
Yeah.
And presumably that equation somehow embodies the good assumptions.
So the problem is this term is being calculated explicitly, not necessarily correctly, right? But if this were correct, if we take your example, if you have UR, and let's say it's exact, this term would be exact. And the problem is this term right here. You see, this is time derivative. So the next time step, whether this term...
But the model is deterministic.
Yeah.
So, right, it's saying something very specific about what's happening at the wall.
Yes.
And I'm just asking, what sort of physics is in it? Because,
the only thing
I know about happening to the wall is the momentum flux is constant. I don't know what else to say about the wall. So, does this model say that or something else?
What do you mean by constant?
Well, just
a
wall
to wall. It's very tricky.
But all I know is, of course, average. So, I'm happy if I'm told here that now we're going to just say that the flux into the wall locally is given by U squared.
No, it's not true.
Okay, but I don't know whether it's true in nature, and I don't know if it's true for the model. The
calculations blow up.
What calculations?
Calculations, okay.
Right, this doesn't blow up, and the nature doesn't blow up.
No, I think the case that, of course, you're referring to is the high Reynolds number, zero pressure boundary layer near the wall. There's this Couette flow region that people, have measured. It says that the stresses the vertical stress is roughly constant in the inertial layer. That's what you're saying.
Right, that's all.
Right.
So
now that's a measured, that's a measured result. And the question is, does your model predict that?
Well, you know, I think that was a business point, but it's true on average.
It's true on average, yes.
Well, here, for the equation, you have to say something like this, instantaneous and pointwise.
Sure. Well, that's, of course, the nature of an LES.
Right.
You're saying something instantaneous and pointwise on a coarse grid.
So if that's what we said, instantaneous and pointwise.
Yeah, well, it's not explicitly in the model, if that's what you're asking. In our application, the stress is not constant. There is no Couette layer. First of all, our pressure gradients are not zero. Right? That immediately destroys the Couette layer. Also, we have momentum flux, vertical momentum flux driven by buoyancy. So we don't have the situation that you're talking about. But even if we did, the answer is it's not explicitly in the model. And I think your question is a very good one because it's something that we struggle with as well. People say, well, we have MO similarity in our application. You have law of the wall in engineering applications. Should one introduce explicitly law of the wall into your formalism? And of course, then you're limiting your application to places where law of the wall exists.
Jim,
right?
One comment. This is a very important point what you're saying.
Yeah.
Jim Dierger, in 69, he started with first LES. What he did is exactly what you say. He introduced by hand the law of the wall as a boundary condition. Then he started running simulations, and he was never able to generate log layer. And why? The same happened with us. We did it many times. The trouble there is that you in the mean this log layer is satisfied, but in order to generate this log layer, you have to have this very spotty turbulent production, and only God knows how to generate. So how to model? So remarkable. In the K epsilon like simulations, you put log layer, boundary conditions, you get a wonderful result. In LES, you put log layer in. You think you will get log layer back. No. This spottiness kills it, kills what you introduce, what you put in.
Well,
so maybe your model will be better. Maybe your model will do a good job.
I don't know how much.
But you cannot, but what you're saying, yeah. You cannot do.
I think to rephrase what Victor is saying, there's a local dynamics. You know, if you're doing Reynolds decomposition, right? Then you're only calculating the mean, and you kind of like force the mean to behave a certain way near the ground. So, but here there's more degrees of freedoms. But still, there is a kind of a. I think your point is a good one too, and there's kind of an interaction between local dynamics and a kind of a statistical dynamics that lives underneath the grid cells. I mean, after all, we aren't resolving, especially near the ground, we aren't resolving much of the spectrum. So this is, you know, we're modeling the average effect of that on these sides. And then if you're doing what's called a very large eddy simulation or a time average RAND simulation, then you're even, you know, way down here. But still, you're calculating time evolving fluctuations, spatial variations on grids and so on.
Yeah, but then the intermittency is much smaller because the small scales are not there at all. You just get rid of them.
Right.
Intermittency is much smaller, and you can recover the log layer. This is a very interesting and peculiar situation.
Yeah. So to extend again, a little bit more.
Yeah, but if you try it, just take your model and put it into the general flow and see what happens.
That's what we're working on two things now: the LES of the atmospheric boundary layer. We're sticking it into that now, and then we're doing channel flow as well. So that's hopefully a year from now. I'll have some results for you on that.
A year from now.
You have better people than I.
What about next week?
Well, right now we're doing the ABL because we're getting our funding to do ABL stuff. So the channel flow will come next. Yeah.
In order to have several eddy turnover times far from the wall, you have to run many, many eddy turnover times close to the wall.
Well, eddy turnover time is depends on how you define it, but if you're talking about a local eddy turnover time, then yeah, the integral scale is smaller near the wall. Time scales are smaller near the wall, so that would be true.
So you can do that and still don't have errors propagating there. So
and still don't have errors?
Errors coming forward in time.
Why? Sorry, I missed it. What's your point? I don't quite get it.
Well, there is an error that builds up over time.
Yes.
In the model near the surface.
Yes. You have to remember, of course, these time scales are all they're all interacting at the same time. So you've got like a large sweeping time scale schematically in this picture. These blue lines, there's a very large eddy time scale associated with these. So if you calculate several of these, the errors that you're making here are basically getting swept up and around two or three or four or five times. So the longer you let that go, the more the errors sort of propagate up into the upper part of the boundary there. I'm not sure if that's your point or not.
Well, you have runs for this model already.
Well, not in the atmospheric boundary layer yet. We've only done it for homogeneous turbulence. We're working on the atmospheric boundary layer right now. Yeah.
So we'll wait a year.
Yeah, or less than a year.
A week.
Not a week. I can guarantee you not a week. Because right now, Young is trying to figure out how to run the atmospheric boundary layer code. It's not a trivial code. It's a very complicated code. And he's also trying to run it on a multiprocessor machine and all the rest of it. So we're trying to do big calculations. You know.
Jim, is there any role for stochastic backscattering in any of these?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think Boris sort of alluded to the fact that there is a stochastic component that lives in our grid cell. And I always have in the back of my head the potential need to introduce some kind of a random part to the model. That's basically what Dave Mason did, even though he called it backscatter. I never liked his term. Basically, it's saying, look, there's a random component that we have no hope of capturing. So let's just stick it in ad hoc and see what it does. And I think the reason that his model...
I think I called it backscatter first. He took it from me.
Really? Oh.
I'm to blame for that.
Well, I think that was a bad choice, Chuck. Because I don't think it has to do with backscatter at all. I think it has to do with randomness. And if you look at our 1998 paper where we're looking at structure, and we decided that what is happening is that the coherence is too strong, or these streaks is too strong near the ground. So whatever you do that destroys this coherence is going to have a beneficial effect. And that's essentially what he does. He destroys the coherence. Of course, he doesn't realize that that's what he's doing when he introduced the model, but that is effectively what he's doing.
I was puzzled that it seemed to be more beneficial like walls than it was anywhere else.
Yeah.
And I didn't expect that at all.
I think that's the reason. Uh-huh. This is the reason.
And in a sense, since you're keeping this linear coupling between the resolved and the subgrid, you can imagine that the subgrids are the linear models with the absolute noise source, right?
Where, oh, I see what you're saying.
Right, stable and unstable depending on what the resulting is.
Yeah, are you talking about the stochastic model now?
Well,
in mine, yeah. Well, why do you call it a linear coupling? They're nonlinear couplings. Maybe it's a semantics issue.
Maybe this is equation for
these terms.
Your equation for S1, right? Presumably we'll have somewhere the term which looks like UR dot grad US1.
Yeah, UR dot grad US1, that's just...
So there you go. So it's linear in US1.
Yeah, in US1, right. But then these two terms are nonlinear. This is nonlinear in UR, and this is nonlinear in US. You're right, this term is linear, formally linear. Right.
Okay, maybe.